The content of this program, is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles initially from the Harvard Health Letter. This is the November 2024 issue of the Harvard Health Letter. And the first article is entitled, Fear of Falling. Do you have an emergency plan? Here is what to expect and what to do if you fall. You're doing everything you can to avoid a fall, but sometimes tumbles occur. Despite best efforts, one in four U.S. adults aged 65 and older report falling in any given year. As common as these accidents are, most of us never consider what to do in the event of a fall. How would you get help? Should you contact your doctor or go to a hospital? What would happen after that? If you haven't already, it's time to come up with a basic emergency plan while you're healthy and can think calmly and clearly. Ask someone to be your emergency contact in case of a fall, especially if you live alone. It should be someone in your area who will help you with decision-making, which can be overwhelming when you fall. You might also need the person to assist you with transportation or recuperation, says Dr. Julia Webb, an interventional physiatrist at Harvard-affiliated Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital. She specializes in non-surgical treatment for back and neck pain, which often results from falls and fractures. You'll be handy if your emergency contact is also your healthcare proxy, the person you've named to make your healthcare decisions if you're unable to make them yourself. This designation requires a legal, notarized document called a durable power of attorney for healthcare. Such documents are available for free online, usually at a state health department or a nonprofit agency website like the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization at www.caringinfo.org. That's CARINGINFO.org. You can also have your attorney create the document. If you fall and aren't able to summon help, a medical alert system can call your emergency contacts and 911 at the touch of a button. The button is in a device that you can wear as a pendant around your neck or as a bracelet on your wrist. The device communicates via cell phone technology or your landline phone to people who can help you. Some devices have built-in fall detection, so they call for help if they sense you've fallen. You also can signal an emergency using an app on your smartphone, smartwatch, or smart speaker. Costs range from $20 to $50 per month, and equipment might cost extra. You might be confused or overwhelmed if you fall, but if you can, try to do two things. First, note what's happened to you and what your symptoms are. Take a body survey as soon as possible. Can you wiggle your toes and feel everything? Did you hit your head and lose consciousness? Are you cut and bleeding? Second, get help immediately. Don't put off this call, even if you think you're okay. Sometimes it's obvious that you need to call 911 after a fall. You might be bleeding or have a terrible hip or back pain that's immobilized you. But it might not be clear that you're hurt and have an injury that warrants a trip to the hospital. How can you tell the difference? If you hit your head, it's always better to err on the side of caution and go to the emergency department right away, Dr. Webb says. That's particularly true if you're taking a blood thinner and hit your head. It can cause serious bleeding in your brain, even if you think you're fine. If you didn't hit your head, you aren't having pain, and you're able to move everything, it's reasonable to call your primary care doctor and ask if an appointment is necessary. If it isn't, remain alert for delayed signs of injury. Symptoms can appear a few hours or even a few days later, Dr. Webb says. Watch for headaches, dizziness, imbalance, muscle weakness, numbness, difficulty speaking. Feeling faint, changes in bladder or bowel function, sore muscles or joints, neck or back pain, or blurry vision. Call your doctor to report these symptoms immediately. What happens at a hospital or doctor's office depends on your injury. In a doctor's office, expect questions about what caused your fall. The doctor will perform a physical exam and a basic test of vision, balance, and thinking skills. Review your medication and try to determine if an underlying condition caused your fall. Your doctor might also order x-rays to check for broken bones or head trauma. In the hospital, you'll get a brain scan if you hit your head, and x-rays if the doctor suspects you have a broken bone. You might need surgery for a bad break, like a hip fracture. After a hospital visit or stay, you might need to go to a rehabilitation facility, outpatient therapy, or follow up a doctor's appointment. Because you know all of this in advance, there's time to think about how you might navigate the logistics of a fall and your recovery. How would you get groceries or take care of yourself? Do you have a budget to hire health aides to help while you're recuperating? What are the reputable health aid companies in town? What would you do for transportation? Talk to your family or healthcare proxy about the options, just in case. It's never too early to be prepared. And attached to this article is a short summary of called Fall Prevention 101. One of the most important ways to prevent falls is removing hazards at home and at work if possible, like throw rugs, electric cords on the floor, and furniture blocking your path. Be sure handrails are securely fastened to the wall and that lighting fixtures have working bulbs. Install grab bars and floor treads in bathrooms and add night lights throughout your home for midnight trips to the bathroom or kitchen. If you have an assistive device, use it at all times. Don't hold on to furniture to get across a room. Use your cane or walker. Give your body a moment to adjust when you get out of bed. Sit up first, get your bearings, then stand up and wait a few seconds before taking a step. Do you have poor balance or vision, painful joints, or medication side effects? Talk with your doctor about how to reduce fall risks associated with these problems. Now we're going to turn to Ask the Doctor in the Harvard Health Letter. This is with Dr. Anthony Komaroff, who's the editor-in-chief of the Health Letter. And the question is it true that a reliable blood test for Alzheimer's disease is finally here? And Dr. Komaroff responds, yes, but not the blood test we need the most. Let me explain. What is finally here is a blood test to help diagnose Alzheimer's in people who already are having significant cognitive difficulties. About a third of the cases of dementia in the United States have another cause, so we need to distinguish Alzheimer's disease from other causes. An encouraging study published in July 2024 in JAMA found that a simple blood test detecting elevated blood levels of proteins that characterized Alzheimer's disease was quite accurate in diagnosing the condition. Armed with the results of the blood test, doctors became more accurate in their diagnosis. That's real progress, but it's not the test we need most. Alzheimer's disease takes decades to develop. During that time, it's silent, producing no cognitive symptoms. Scientists are trying to develop blood tests to accurately spot the developing disease long before it affects thinking. But such tests are not here yet. The Holy Grail is a combination of two things: a blood test that accurately identifies people who are in the earliest stages of developing Alzheimer's, and a treatment that, when given to such people, stops the disease in its tracks. Long before it impairs thinking. We're not there yet. Many scientists believe that starting treatment during its early silent stages could prevent the disease from ever affecting a person's ability to think. But that remains to be proved. In the past 30 years, we have developed ways of detecting the disease during its silent early stages. Brain scans can detect the buildup of Alzheimer's-related proteins, but these scans are very expensive. Some involve exposing a person to radiation, and they can be frightening for people who have claustrophobia or fear of being in confined spaces. We also can measure Alzheimer's-related proteins in spinal fluid, a clear fluid that circulates around the brain and spinal cord. But this requires a spinal tap, which can be uncomfortable. This may seem discouraging, but it should not be. I take a long view. When I was in medical school, Dr. Komaroff says, we had little idea of what caused Alzheimer's disease. There was no way of diagnosing the disease except by doing an autopsy, and we had no good treatments. In other words, we were nowhere with this terrible disease. Today, we've identified several causes. We have a simple blood diagnostic test, and we have treatments that are somewhat effective. When will we achieve the Holy Grail? That's hard to predict, but the progress over the past 20 years makes me cautiously optimistic, says Dr. Komaroff. Now, here's another article from the Harvard Health Letter, and it's entitled, Antidepressants, Not Just for Mood Disorders. The medications are also used to treat pain, insomnia, headaches, and more. If your doctor prescribes an antidepressant for a condition other than depression or anxiety, you might not get the connection. Just hear the doctor out. Some medications used to treat depression also turn out to treat a variety of other health problems. How do antidepressants work? Antidepressants influence brain chemicals called neurotransmitters that help to regulate mood and other body functions and behaviors. These medications come in a number of classes, and each one works a little bit differently. For example, there are the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs. Examples are Prozac and Celexa. These help to raise the level of the neurotransmitter serotonin in the brain by slowing its reabsorption. Serotonin affects mood, arousal, anxiety, impulses, and aggression. Then there's the serotonin and norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, the SNRIs. Examples are Effexor and Cymbalta. These raise the levels of serotonin and norepinephrine, which increases alertness, but also increases heart rate and blood pressure. Then there's the tricyclic and tetracyclic antidepressants, like amitriptyline, which raise the level of serotonin and norepinephrine, as well as acetylcholine, which affects memory and muscle function. Then there's the serotonin modulators, like trazodone, which work in several ways by influencing the function of numerous brain cell receptors, often leading to a sedating effect or sleepiness. Then there's bupropion or Wellbutrin. This medication is in its own class and targets norepinephrine as well as dopamine, which affects pleasure, movement, focus, and many body functions. Antidepressants are not just for your mood. Because antidepressants affect many brain chemicals, they're used to treat conditions other than depression, although they're often prescribed in much lower doses for those purposes. For example, they're used to treat insomnia. A number of antidepressants can suppress arousal symptoms in the brain or activate sedating symptoms. For example, trazodone is one of the most commonly prescribed medications for sleep in the United States. It suppresses the fight or flight activating system. Doxepin, or Silanor, blocks histamine in the brain, which is an activating neurotransmitter, says Dr. John Winkelman, a sleep medicine specialist and professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Then there's headaches. Some antidepressants are first-line treatment for prevention of migraine headaches or tension-type headaches. For example, if I have a patient with frequent migraines and problems with anxiety or depression, which migraine is associated with, venlafaxine is helpful. In addition to influencing serotonin levels, it also appears to work on receptors involved in perceiving pain, says Dr. Sayeet Ashina, a neurologist who specializes in headache treatment at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. By the way, venlafaxine is a generic name for Effexor. Then there's gynecologic pain. We use antidepressants for a fair number of people who have bladder pain, chronic pelvic pain, or vaginal pain after intercourse, says William Winkelman, a urogynecologist at Harvard-affiliated Mount Auburn Hospital. I often prescribe tricyclic antidepressants as an add-on therapy or even as a primary treatment. For some people, it gives tremendous relief. Then there's nerve pain. SNRIs. Remember, those are Effexor and Cymbalta, are our first line of defense for nerve pain. The drugs might help dampen pain, especially the small nerve fibers at the ends of the fingers and toes, says Dr. Stephanie Collier, a psychiatrist at Harvard-affiliated McLean Hospital. Antidepressants might also ease symptoms of irritable bowel syndrome, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, fibromyalgia, chronic low back pain, or arthritis pain. Like most medications, antidepressants can have side effects. SSRIs can cause gastrointestinal side effects like loose stools, weight gain, headaches, nausea, or vomiting. Tricyclics can cause dry eyes and dry mouth, which might persist and require treatment. Another example is taking trazodone for insomnia might leave people feeling too groggy in the morning. We often advise taking smaller doses or taking the medication earlier in the evening, Dr. John Winkelman says. Some people might feel there's a stigma involved in taking an antidepressant. That can make some people hesitant, Dr. Ashina says. But when I explain that antidepressant medications also help other conditions, they're often inclined to try it. Now here's another article in the Harvard Health Letter. Again, this is the November 2024 issue. And the article is entitled, Breathe Better After a Chest Cold, Flu, Pneumonia, or COVID. Try exercises that clear your lungs and improve lung function. Winter is almost here, along with an increased risk for infections that can settle in your lungs, like flu, pneumonia, COVID-19, or bronchitis. If you get one of these illnesses, beware that it can leave you with two lung problems, even when you're feeling better. One is mucus secretions of the lung that fester, continue the infection, and make it hard to breathe. The other is weakness in the respiratory muscles that move the lungs. To recover successfully, take action with a few exercises. First, how would you go about clearing out mucus secretions? If you notice a rattle or congestion in your lungs, try some exercises to clear mucus secretions. The first is called huffing. Huffing is exhaling like you're trying to fog up a mirror. It's a little more forceful than the way you normally exhale. When you have mucus in your lungs, huffing helps keep the airway open, making it easier to clear secretions. Take a deep breath in, hold it for a few seconds, then huff slowly for as long as you can. That will push air out, move secretions, and trigger a productive cough. Repeat the process, but not so many times that it causes discomfort. Huff and cough whenever you need to clear secretions throughout the day. And don't swallow them, spit them out, says Heather Philbin, a physical therapist who teaches breathing techniques and helps people regain respiratory muscle strength at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Hospital. Then there's using vibrations. You can purchase a small tool online called a flutter valve or an acapella valve. It might look like a child's bubble pipe or kazoo. You blow into it and hear small balls fluttering inside it. The vibrations reach into your airways and help loosen secretions. Try to cough after using the tool. The secretions loosened by the vibration may be coughed up more easily. Another possibility is to perform an active cycle of breathing. That's a series of breaths and coughs that dislodge mucus in the lungs. Take four relaxed breaths, then take four deep breaths, holding each one for 3 seconds before exhaling. Follow that with four relaxed breaths, then three huffing exhalations, and then cough. Another exercise that you can do is done with the help of a physical therapist in an outpatient clinic. It's called postural drainage. You lie down and a physical therapist pats your chest like a drum over the congested area of the lung. Then you can do things to strengthen your breathing muscles. Your respiratory muscles can lose strength if you have an extended illness or one that requires you to go on a ventilator. If you're feeling short of breath, Philbin recommends the following exercises. The first is diaphragmatic breathing. For difficulty inhaling, strengthen your diaphragm, the large dome-shaped muscle below your lungs. To tell if you're using your diaphragm, lie on your back, place one hand on your belly, and breathe deeply. Your hand and belly should rise as you breathe in. Take 10 nice, slow, even breaths and focus on breathing. Rest for a minute and repeat the process. Once you feel confident that you're using your diaphragm to breathe while lying down, try the exercise while sitting up and eventually while standing. In time, you'll strengthen your diaphragm and train yourself to rely on it instead of muscles at the top of the lungs, which are less effective. Once you're good at diaphragmatic breathing, try using a respiratory trainer. That's another kazoo-like device that you place in your mouth. It provides resistance to breathing, which makes your diaphragm work harder. With the device in your mouth, take in deep breaths and then exhale fully. Set the resistance at a level that you can perform 10 times in a row at a moderate difficulty level. Do this 2 to 3 times daily, Philbin says. Finally, there's pursed lip breathing. If you have difficulty exhaling, pursed lip breathing will help keep the airways open. Purse your lips as if you're slowly blowing out a candle or blowing air through a thin straw. While pursing, inhale as much as you can, then exhale fully. If it helps, breathe through an actual straw. Like diaphragmatic breathing, pursed lip breathing at rest is done until you can do it while walking or climbing stairs. With all these exercises, the goal is using the proper breathing technique. so that they become second nature and help you breathe better when you're out in the real world, Philbin says. And then, just briefly, it turns out that shingles is tied to cognitive decline, according to news briefs in the Harvard Health Letter. Here's more incentive to get a shingles vaccine if you haven't already. A new Harvard-led study has found that having shingles is linked to an increased risk of developing cognitive decline years later. Remember, shingles is reactivation of the chickenpox virus. Researchers evaluated the health records and periodic questionnaire answers of 149,000 middle-aged and older people. Compared with those in the study who did not have shingles, those who did had a 20% higher risk of later developing what the study called subjective cognitive decline. They noticed that they were having trouble with remembering recent events or a short list of items, following instructions, or recalling the plot of a TV show. People with SCD are at greater risk for developing dementia. Researchers also found that the risk of SCD, or subjective cognitive decline, among participants was higher in men who were carriers of an Alzheimer's gene, APOE4, and in people who were not vaccinated against shingles. The study was published in a journal called Alzheimer's Research and Therapy and does not prove definitively that shingles causes subjective cognitive decline. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.